exemption from getting permission or providing payment for use of the work. This is the last category, which is most troublesome from the perspective of a copyright holder. If Congress were writing the statute from scratch, it would probably not look the way it does. As time passes, it is incumbent on Congress to reevaluate the various provisions of the licensing structure to see how markets or businesses have changed and whether it is time to reform the law. Currently, Section 114 provides a compulsory license to publicly perform a sound recording whereas there is a digital audio transmission. Terrestrial broadcasters, however, aren't required to pay a royalty for their transmissions. They enjoy an exemption from the digital performance right. Historically, the broadcasters have argued that the exemption is appropriate because of the symbiotic relationship that exists between the over-the-air airplay on radio and the promotion of the music leading to future sales. To a certain extent, the existence of payola was evidence of this idea. Furthermore, the broadcaster suggests that to incur a further requirement for compensation for sound recordings to artists and musicians, that's tantamount to a performance tax. Finally, there is concern as to how smaller broadcasters will survive if required to pay it. I'm sure we'll hear cogent arguments from our witnesses today about the history of the exemption for broadcasters and the effect of providing a performance right. However, I'd like to initially engage on a number of these arguments, and the primary question, is there justification today for this exemption given the number of outlets for music and how consumers acquire it? First, rights parity. Regardless of whether there remains a symbiotic relationship and whether, in fact, airplay constitutes promotion or substitution, there is an equity argument that has been consistently ignored. Performers and musicians as creators should be entitled to control use and at least receive revenue for their works. That Patsy Cline's estate is not compensated for the over-the-air performance of her rendition of Crazy seems crazy. In addition, my notion is that removal of a government compulsion for labels, artists, and musicians to provide something for free, that repeal of the exemption removal, removal of that compulsion is not a tax. In fact, if anything, the government's provision of free spectrum to radio stations is a tax to benefit broadcasters imposed on U.S. taxpayers who pay for it. Platform parity. Neither in the past has there been more engaging technological platforms which offer music to consumers at almost any time in any format, especially with the rollout of high-definition radio, which will provide more choice. It becomes harder to justify an exemption for any one platform. Satellite, internet, and cable all provide and promote music to their listeners, yet all pay fair compensation to artists and musicians. Then there's international parity. Because America does not have an adequate performance right, we disadvantage our own creators because they can't receive foreign royalties. In many countries, between 20 and 50% of the music played abroad is American-made. And because of lack of reciprocity, we're denying our creators millions of dollars in revenue. As we work towards crafting a bill, I take note of at least two considerations. One is that we need to ensure that songwriters are not adversely affected by the elimination of the broadcast exemption. I would note, however, in countries where there is a performance right for sound recordings, as well as a performance right for musical compositions, there's been no decrease in the royalties to owners of musical composition. In fact, the royalties have grown over time, as have royalties for performers and sound recording owners. Furthermore, I am open to a special consideration for small broadcasters. Just one last note. Because I've heard from business establishments and others, let me start out today's hearing by saying that this subcommittee's examination of their performance right is limited to reevaluating the current exemption in the compulsory license for terrestrial broadcast radio. We are not considering the extension of a full performance right for sound recordings like the one afforded musical works. Thus, restaurants, bars, establishments, venues, and others who pay performance royalties to songwriters and music publishers would not be affected. Rather, because there is a special exemption in the current compulsory license for radio services that benefits only terrestrial radio over other types of radio, the question is whether circumstances have changed so that it is now time to reconsider that particular exemption. I now have the great pleasure of introducing my friend and ranking member. But before I do that, I'm going to introduce, if he doesn't mind, because the chairman of the committee has to go to the floor, our distinguished chairman. All right, what we're doing is we're going to recognize the chair and then the ranking member of the full committee and then the ranking member of the subcommittee. If I had known this before I started talking, I might have done it before I went ahead. But Mr. Conyers, you're recognized.
Thank you, my good friend. I'm delighted to have heard you, because now that we've heard everything on the subject, we can just welcome our witnesses, and that's all I want to do today. And I have to stay here from the floor. We have a lobbying bill up. We've been working on this package, and my good friend Howard Coble and I are both due on the floor. Lamar. Oh, Lamar is due on the floor. Okay. Lamar Smith is due on the floor as well. All I wanted to do is say hello to Sam Moore and let him know that I'll be seeing Aretha Franklin in Detroit when the session ends, and I'll be giving her your good regards. And Judy Collins, one of our favorite artists, we're so happy to see you today, my dear. It's great for you all to be here. Let me just say that that it's very important that we realize how unfair the system is to artists and other music platforms as artists under the current law. They're not compensated when their songs are played on broadcast radio, and you know that's my big thing to examine here today. Satellite pays, internet pays, broadcast still hasn't come around. Now, there was a time when just being played on the radio would do it. That would make you. But those days, as everybody here knows, are not the same anymore. We have so many different venues, and it's in this sense that songwriters who receive compensation regardless of which platform performs their songs, artists are only paid when their songs are played over the internet, on satellite radio or cable. I just want to conclude, and I'll put in the record my remarks, is that I think we can work out some kind of compensation package, Chairman Berman, without harming the songwriters. And they've had to come through a long period of time for them to be compensated. So over the years, it's been debated whether Congress should amend current law to eliminate the specific exemption for broadcasters from the duty of paying the performance royalty. And we should all be mindful of the potential impact this right would have on songwriters who currently are paid every time their songs are played on radio. And so I'm going to review this testimony carefully. I'm so glad that all of you are here today. It's great to see all those who have worked so hard. And as I look out over the audience, I see a lot of people connected to this entertainment industry here today, not excluding people who've worked on the Hill for so many years. And so maybe there is a connection between what I'm going to do on the floor and what's going on here. Who knows? Thank you for this opportunity, Mr. Chairman.
If when you come back, half the audience is gone, we'll know you. I'm now pleased to recognize the ranking member of the full committee, who also has to go to the floor on the same piece of legislation. The gentleman from Texas, ranking member Lamar Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also want to thank Mr. Coble for deferring to me and yielding me the time to go ahead of him in making an opening statement. And as already been mentioned, let me apologize to our witnesses today that unfortunately I do need to go to the floor along with the chairman to manage the a certain lobbying reform bill, so I will not be able to stay as I would like to. Clearly, though, it's obvious that there is a lot of interest in the subject today, and deservedly so. Mr. Chairman, thank you for convening today's oversight hearing on music licensing and the proposal to expand the performance royalty to cover over-the-air radio broadcast of sound recordings. With the subcommittee's high-profile emphasis on advancing patent reform this Congress, a casual observer could easily presume that copyright issues in general and music issues in particular have not received much attention so far. That conclusion would be wrong. This oversight hearing marks the third copyright-focused hearing in the IP subcommittee this year to focus on the protection and promotion of the music industry and the rights of recording artists and composers. Mr. Chairman, you and I have spent a great deal of time, both personal time and public time, over the past several Congresses working together in a bipartisan effort to streamline, modernize, and improve the music licensing process with the shared goal of adapting the compulsory license process to the digital age. Over this time, we've made tremendous progress in identifying and narrowing many of the process-related issues. But the goal of enacting a public law and actually implementing some of our agreed reforms remains. I continue to believe this task can be achieved in this Congress. Unlike our effort to reform the process for clearing the legal rights to use copyrighted musical works and sound recordings and adjudicating the royalties to be paid to recording artists and copyright owners, the subject of today's hearing is one that affects the substantive rights of these parties as well as the subtle expectations of those in the traditional radio broadcasting industry. The goal of enacting a full statutory performance right for sound recordings is one that has been sought by performing artists and the recording industry for many years. It has only been 12 years since Congress first provided a limited public performance right in sound recordings with the enactment of the Digital Performance Right in Sound Recordings Act, a law that made available a compulsory license for sound recordings to non-interactive cable and satellite services. But in that span of a dozen years, recording artists, along with the music and broadcasting industries, have confronted many unanticipated challenges and experienced seismic changes. Competition and technological advances have generated both positive and negative aspects for all. The transition to high-definition radio holds great promise for broadcasters. In contrast, the trend among young consumers to download the music they want, sometimes legally but all too often illegally, rather than purchase CDs or other physical media, holds great peril for recording artists and record labels. I consider this subject to be one whose significance should not be underestimated, and I hope we will address it this year. Mr. Chairman, I'll yield back the balance of my time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Smith. And now the ranking member of the subcommittee, who, when he was chairman, we were delving into this issue as well, Mr. Howard Coble, North Carolina.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I want to repeat what the others have said. It's good to have this distinguished panel before us, and I would be remiss if I did not recognize especially our distinguished registrar. Good to have you back, Mary Beth. Mr. Chairman, the stated purpose of today's hearing is to begin an examination of concerns that relate to proposals to remove the exemption for terrestrial radio broadcasts and the copyright compulsory license for public performances. What that means in layman's terms is the subcommittee intends to consider whether the copyright law should be amended to require over-the-air broadcasters to pay compensation directly to recording artists when their songs are played over the radio. If the testimony of the two recording artists who are with us today represents the views of other musicians and performers, then it seems there is a fairly strong consensus in that community that the law should be so amended. Indeed, the Copyright Office and the record labels also share that perspective, asserting that a principled and consistent application of the copyright law requires that audio transmissions of sound recordings ought to benefit from the same performance right that has been extended to music publishers and composers for nearly a century. Not surprisingly, the broadcasters who would be statutorily obliged to pay such a royalty and who are represented by the National Association of Broadcasters consider such an amendment to be an anathema. Their view is that Congress should leave well enough alone. That is, unless the Congress wishes to amend the compulsory copyright license to enable broadcasters to stream their signals over the Internet without paying a performance royalty to performers or to lighten the regulatory and reporting requirements required when a broadcaster chooses to simulcast its signals over the web. Proponents, Mr. Chairman, appear to rely upon three main arguments in asserting that the over-the-air broadcast exemption should be jettisoned. One, the exemption was never justified as a matter of copyright law, but today serves as an anachronism and a glaring inequity. Two, the copyright law requires cable, satellite, and internet radio services to pay performance royalties to both composers and recording artists. Therefore, non-discrimination and platform parity demand that traditional radio broadcasters should also pay a proportionate share. And finally, the United States is alone among free market economic powers in denying a performance right in terrestrial radio broadcast to artists and performers. Among other things, the broadcasters conversely respond they already pay $450 million a year in performance royalties to composers and music publishers. They contend over-the-air radio has a symbolic relationship with recording artists who benefit from free promotional airplay, which in turn spurs demand for product sales, touring promotions, and souvenir revenue. Traditional radio formats, which do not include multi-channel offerings of various music formats, do not pose a serious threat to the distribution of sound recordings, they contend. Broadcasters are subject to numerous Commerce Committee and FCC-imposed statutory and regulatory obligations that justify exemptions from the ordinary application of the copyright law. And finally, the United States recording and broadcasting industries are unique, and policies implemented elsewhere are not appropriate for United States conditions. Believe it or not, this summary barely touches the surface of the strongly held views that will soon be articulated by the parties involved in this debate. As the subcommittee embarks on this examination, Mr. Chairman, I am mindful of other interests not directly represented here today. For instance, the public benefits enormously when Congress exercises in an appropriate manner the authority granted in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, which calls upon us to promote creativity and expression by securing for limited times to authors the exclusive right to their writings. In addition, I think it's important to bear in mind the interests of other copyright owners, which should not be diminished by any prospective changes in the law. Mr. Chairman, in closing, I will simply note that I look forward to learning more about the intricacies of this debate and by observing that I have friends on both sides of this issue. All of you I embrace very warmly. I recall, Mr. Chairman, I think one of the first hearings I attended as a freshman member of Congress, I heard a member in this very hearing room conclude his remarks with these words. He said, "I have friends on both issues of this subject, and I want to make it perfectly clear, I'm with my friends." If it were only that easy, Mr. Chairman, I hope at the day's end that no one will feel rejected, that all will feel embraced, and that we can get something that with which everyone can live. And finally, Mr. Chairman, I have a Coast Guard hearing that I may have to attend with your permission later on, and I don't want my abrupt departure to be indicating that I'm not interested in this very, very important issue. And I yield back, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you very much. Hopefully you get to the panel as soon as possible, but given that I don't really have clean hands, having spent at least 7 or so minutes with an opening statement, are there any other members who want to make comments at this time? Mr. Issa.
Mr. Chairman, there wouldn't be any possibility that it wouldn't be appropriate to make just a few comments here today, because I think what you're doing here is so monumental. In my 7 years in Congress, this is the first time that in a no ifs, ands, or buts way, it's been made clear that the status quo will no longer be acceptable. Although this is a hearing and not a markup, I think we all understand here today that the broadcasters are on notice that we intend to look at a reorganization of this. I certainly hope that we have additional follow-up hearings. I certainly would like to see a panel that was all made up of broadcasters and broadcaster-related people, giving us sort of their view, in addition to what we're going to hear today, of how they're going to deal in a more balanced way. Certainly, as Mr. Coble said, it's very clear that finding a common platform where broadcast and simulcast can be dealt with fairly should be on the table. I believe that, in fact, the broadcasters should embrace this as an opportunity to create transparency between what they presently do on a terrestrial basis and the other ventures that these companies are now expanding into. I think the fact that high definition digital is about to go to high power, high definition digital, it's very clear that we're going to need to make that this move in a timely fashion, because what has been coming out in the satellite industry for a number of years is clearly going to be coming out of our radios in our cars as we drive. Additionally, digital recording devices are going to be undoubtedly made by the consumer electronics industry to record on-air broadcast as it has never been recorded before, in digital format, in a sound quality that very much will be, for most people's ears, the equivalent of CDs. I certainly also think that we in Congress have long ago lost our clean hands on the concept that broadcasters are promoting. It's very clear that perhaps Judy Collins or Sam Moore a few years ago, in earlier part of your careers, might well have signed away for 3, 5, or 10 years the rights to receive any royalties from their performance in return for a guarantee that they would be promoted when their songs were not so, or their music was not so well regarded. It is also clear that artists who are deceased, their estates today cannot say, we're going to perform, we're not going to go on the road. Mr. Moore was here previously talking about when you're no longer on the road, but somebody else is saying they're you, and we've already dealt with some of those. It is very, very clear, though, that we need to create a recognition that the artist, performing artist, has a right. The broadcaster must show any offset to that right. That's why not only am I thrilled that you're holding this hearing today, but I am encouraging that we thoughtfully go through listening to all parties, because I think the change we make is a change that we make for the rest of the world, who today provide a revenue stream for performing artists. Well, we don't. If we're going to make a change, let's make a change we're all proud of. With that, I yield back.
I thank the gentleman, and the gentleman from Tennessee.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Gentleman from Tennessee, I feel like Johnny Cash, something like that. But I just wanted
another guy with a predisposition.
Well, I just wanted to testify what your voices have meant to me. I guess the system is now, if you're the songwriter, which is a great talent, composer, you get paid, but if you sing and perform, you don't. And our performers we have out here, and Ms. Collins, I've listened to a lot of your music and over the years, and it has been a lot to me. The writers were brilliant, but without your voice, I wouldn't have been listening to it. And it's the idea that you're getting promoted and that they're doing you some favor as a byproduct. I mean, it should be B-U-Y product. With that logic, they would never pay Muhammad Ali or wouldn't have paid him to show his fights because they were promoting him. So more people would want to go out to the stadium to see him fight or whatever, and they could just show it for free on free TV. Oh, we're promoting you. And the same thing for baseball and football and basketball. We shouldn't have to pay for the show in the Lakers and Kobe. We're giving everybody a chance to see Kobe, and then they'll go to the arena and see Kobe. That's absurd. And they've just kind of gotten a free ride over the years. As great as all the songwriters were, if it weren't for Frank Sinatra, people would not have listened to those songs. And Frank Sinatra should have been compensated as the performers are, just like the songwriters. So as the gentleman from Tennessee and from Memphis in particular, I'm here with the performers and the songwriters and artists being paid for what they do to make our lives better. And I thank each of you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The gentlelady from California.
Thank you,
recognized.
Mr. Chairman. I'll be very brief. I think this is a very useful hearing, and I thank the chairman for scheduling it. I think that the concept of how we level the playing field between in the marketplace is important, as well as the need to make sure that artists get compensated. And so I'm thrilled that we have two artists who I greatly admire that we can listen to. I know that we will not touch on it today, but as we look at this issue of equity among the platforms, I think we need to look at not just who gets paid, but how much. We know that in the internet radio environment right now, and the chairman I know is well aware of this, there are small internet radios that are going to be charged 300% of their revenue. That's not going to work for them. I mean, they're niche stations, Beethoven all the time and the like. So at some point, as we look at making sure artists get paid as they should, we need to figure out how we have equity across all platforms in all ways. And I look forward to being a part of that debate. And I thank the chairman for his leadership on this issue and for this hearing today. And I yield back.
Lady and Mr. Schiff from California.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to be very brief as well. It's an honor to have you with us here today, and as you can tell, we're all fans, and we're just delighted to be in your presence. I appreciate the chairman calling this committee hearing, and not only on this fairly specific issue, but on the broader issue of reform in this area. This is one of those areas of law, I think, that of which there are many in national security and a whole variety of other issues, where if we were starting today drafting the rules of the road, we would never draft a system of anything like this. But we are where we are, and we have to try to either improve it or junk it. I just appreciate our chairman's tenacity in this wildly complex area. And it's nice, actually, today to have a very discreet, very manageable, very understandable issue. And I'm very much looking forward to hearing your testimony. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And now we'll go to the panel. And this, we'll do that. Our first witness, our only colleague who sought to testify, and someone who, based on his unique background, belongs at the panel table, is Congressman Paul Hodes, who represents New Hampshire's 2nd Congressional District. He's president of the freshman congressional class of 2006. Prior to entering Congress, Congressman Hodes was a partner at Shaheen and Gordon. He is well known for his musical talents on the guitar. He and his wife, Pago Hodes, have recorded several albums together that have received critical acclaim from the Parents' Choice Awards. The duo were invited to perform at the White House in 1996, and they continue to perform at many charity and fundraising events, not to mention our caucus. Good to have you here, Paul. Mary Beth Peters, she's been referenced before. She's the United States Register of Copyrights, and with almost 40 years of experience at the U.S. Copyright Office, she is one of the nation's leading experts on copyright law. A graduate of George Washington University School of Law, Ms. Peters has lectured on copyright law at Catholic University's Columbus School of Law, as well as Georgetown University Law Center. She has received numerous awards recognizing her distinguished career, and also served as a consultant on copyright law to the World Intellectual Property Organization in Geneva, Switzerland. Like many of my colleagues, I am a great fan of our next witness. Judy Collins has inspired millions across the globe with her music. Her rendition of Send in the Clowns won the Grammy Award for Song of the Year, and her version of Both Sides Now is part of the Grammys Hall of Fame. Judy Collins continues to enthrall audiences with her voice, her passion, and her grace. Charles Warford Field, Jr., President and Chief Operating Officer of ICBC Broadcast. He oversees nearly 20 radio stations. Mr. Warfield's career in the broadcasting industry spans over 30 years, including serving as Vice President and General Manager of WRKS-FM New York, which was named the most listened to radio station in America. In addition to his work in broadcasting, Mr. Warfield is active with the American Red Cross, the United Negro College Fund, and a partnership for a drug-free Greater New York, among other organizations. Mr. Warfield, it's good to have you here today. And finally, Sam Moore, who has been called the greatest living soul singer and is perhaps best known for his performance of Soul Man and Hold On, I'm Coming, as part of the soul and R&B duo Sam and Dave. Most recently, in 2006, Sam Moore released the critically acclaimed solo album entitled Overnight Sensational, which received a Grammy nomination for the song You Are So Beautiful. His music continues to thrill audiences worldwide, and he's been an inspiration to generation of artists. All of your written statements will be made part of the record. I'd ask you to summarize your testimony in 5 minutes or less. There'll be a timing light at your table, and when 1 minute remains, that light will switch from green to yellow and then red when the 5 minutes are up, and we'd appreciate you summing up at that point, and then we'll have time to talk to you further through questions and dialogue. We welcome you all, and Congressman Hodes, why don't you begin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Ranking Member Coble, members of the subcommittee. I really appreciate the opportunity to testify at this hearing on updating the performance right and platform parity in the 21st century. I am honored beyond description to be on a panel with the distinguished artists who are sitting with me, as well as the members of the industry and the Register of Copyrights for the United States. You know, I was taught as a musician that it all begins with the song. And I have written numbers of songs, which I've published on a small publishing company. I'm a member of ASCAP. And I've also performed other people's songs and recorded other people's songs. And what we're really dealing here today is something very fundamental. While it all begins with the song does not come alive without the performance. Without the performance of on the recording of a song, that song might as well be dust. It might as well sit on a piece of paper in terms of listening to that song. Mr. Coble talked about the argument that the exemption is an anachronism. And I think about the way the music business has changed just in my lifetime. I first recorded in the mid-80s in a studio, was lucky enough to go into a great studio, and when I was done with that recording, it came out on a big, round record. It was vinyl. There was no internet radio, there was no satellite, there was no cable, and I was desperate to try to get some radio play for that vinyl record. And over the years, there has been a revolution in the way we record and distribute music. Today, by contrast, I have a studio in my home with digital equipment. It goes out over the internet. It is transmitted digitally by cable, by satellite. I'm pleased to say that I got a check the other day from Sound Exchange for $19.58. I'm a member of the American Federation of Musicians. I'm proud to be part of that union. I belong to the National Music Publishers Association. I'm a former member of the New Hampshire State Council on the Arts as a counselor. I've been chairman of an arts center, former minority shareholder in a small radio station. And I have really pursued music out of love more than out of money. So in some sense, given that my wife and I have recorded 6 records, I've produced numbers of others, I think I speak for many of the thousands of small independent businesses, because that's what musicians are. They're small businesses who are looking for fairness and justice and looking for ways to make a living through many, many different streams of income. Many. Because like all small businesses, they're struggling with all the issues that affect us today. They're tight budgets. They have to manage their income carefully. I've now come to Congress, and I serve on the Oversight and Government Reform Committee, and I have been pleased to have the opportunity to investigate numerous areas of federal policy that need changing. This area of federal policy is one that has needed change for a very, very long time. I believe that what we are talking about today is rectifying a situation which has needed correction for more years than I have been alive. It is time for terrestrial radio to pay a performance right to performing musicians whose indispensable contribution to bringing the music alive needs to be recognized. I've worked as an entertainment lawyer, and I'll just end with one story. I represented a great artist, African American, was born in Louisiana, who at a young age was taken by a manager to Florida to record a record. And when I asked him what his deal was, because it was somebody else's song that rose very high in the charts at a time when there was only radio, no internet, no satellite, no cable, there was only radio. I asked him what his deal was, and he said, "I don't remember." I said, "Well, was there a contract?" He said, "Not that I know about." And I said, "Have you ever seen any money from that fabulous song which charted really well?" He said, "Well, they paid me $50 and gave me a bottle of scotch." And I went and I tried to track down the deal and the contract. We reached lots of dead ends. He had a tough life and now lives in New Hampshire and is making a good life for himself. On his behalf, I'm here to say it is time to correct the injustice that was done to him for many years when his life should have been easier for a fair and balanced performance royalty because his song was played a lot on the radio. So on his behalf, I say it's time for fairness and justice, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify here today.
Thank you very much, Paul. Ms. Peters?
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Kogel, members of the subcommittee, thank you for the opportunity to testify on removing the existing exemption for the public performance of sound recordings by terrestrial radio broadcast. Sound recordings became subject to federal copyright protection on February 15, 1972. In the 60s and 70s, the main issue was unauthorized duplication of recordings, tape piracy. And the protection given was the right to control the reproduction and distribution of recorded performances. Thus, protection was limited to that which was required to address the then existing problem. Although there was a major push to include a performance right in the 1976 Copyright Act, It was not included. Instead, the Register of Copyrights was charged with studying the problem and delivering a report to Congress by January 3rd of 1978. In her 1978 report, the Register recommended a performing right for sound recording, saying a performance right would bring sound recordings into parity with other categories of copyrightable subject matter. No legislation was enacted in response to the Register's plea. Congressional action was spurred by technologies of the early 1990s, which made it possible to transmit sound recordings digitally throughout the world and allowed individuals to make copies of these transmissions, thereby diminishing the sale of copies, physical copies, and MP3 files. In 1995, when Congress first established a public performance right, it created a very narrow right. In Sections 106(6) and in Section 114, it was limited only to digital transmissions by interactive and subscription services. All other digital transmissions, including over-the-air broadcasts, were exempted. In 1998, the statutory license was broadened to specifically include non-subscription webcast, but not over-the-air broadcast. Today's reality, as you said, is that satellite and cable radio pay, as well as webcasters. Broadcasters do not. The question before you is one of parity. Parity among the users of sound recordings, parity among copyright owners, parity with respect to technology. The goal is leveling the playing field. But it's a matter of basic equity and fairness. It's also a matter of the position of the United States in the area of protection of intellectual property. To achieve equity and parity, the public performance right for sound recordings needs to be broadened to include all commercial transmissions, but especially broadcast. Today, the careful balance that Congress struck in 1995 and 1998 has been undermined by technology, new business models, as well as the change relationship that we've heard about between radio broadcasters and performers of sound recordings. Broadcasters, however, continue to assert that there is a mutually beneficial economic relationship with record companies, citing the promotional value of the performance of sound recordings. Whether there is such a relationship or not, and I tend to think there's not, as a matter of principle and equity, broadcasters should pay royalties for sound recordings they broadcast just as others do. Historically, the record industry has been a very profitable industry, making its money in the United States from distribution of copies. That, coupled with the political clout of broadcasters, basically a clout that they have always enjoyed, has led to today's situation. Today, however, the recording industry is hemorrhaging because of the reproduction and distribution rights, which can no longer generate the revenues to support the industry. In part, that's due to the epidemic of online piracy that we have yet to come to grips with and that we'll never be able to control completely. In part, it's due to technological advances that allow people to get copies for free. So broadcasting is clearly a threat as well as a benefit. In this new environment, we can no longer afford the anomalous treatment that has been accorded to sound recordings as works that are primarily enjoyed by means of performance. They should be subject to public performance rights that provide, at a minimum, compensation from those who financially benefit their public performances. One other point. I'm extremely disappointed and troubled by the persistent characterization of compensation for performers as a tax. This is especially true when broadcasters for the last 8 years have been seeking international protection in the form of exclusive rights for their signals, which, according to their logic, should really be a broadcast tax. Of course, they have never used the word tax with respect to the protection they're seeking. I won't go into it because it's been covered, but there's also the international issue. In conclusion, equity and fairness require the law to be changed to create parity and compensation. Commercial entities who use sound recordings as part of their businesses should pay performers, producers of those recordings. Performers and producers need to be paid for their performances to ensure that the creativity and variety of recordings that we all enjoy continue. It's time to end this anomaly. I agree with you, Mr. Berman, that in doing this, we must ensure that songwriters and music publishers are not negatively affected, and we must ensure that small broadcasters survive. But we can do that through carefully structured legislation that does achieve the appropriate balance. I appreciate the opportunity to express the Copyright Office views on this subject, and I look forward to working with you and Mr. Coble and your staffs on correcting this long-standing imbalance in our law. Thank you.
Thank you, Mavis.
Well, thank you very much, Ms. Peters, and now Judy Collins.
Thank you so much.
Ranking Member Coble, members of the subcommittee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm pleased to be here on behalf of Music First Coalition and my more than 150 fellow founding artists and the thousands of working musicians and singers around the country who care deeply about this issue, which I do consider a glaring inequity. Songs have always told my story and I hope given me a voice to tell others. I learned the love of song from my own father, who was a fine singer and a sometime writer of songs. He knew the secret of hunting for the right song for his voice and taught me that the search for those jewels was the discipline of a singer's life. He was in radio for 30 years, sang his heart out, was never paid a cent for his voice. I believe that musicians and artists, as well as songwriters, should be rewarded and awarded and paid properly for their talent and artistry in making the music and deserving the right to be paid for their creations, whether they are performed or written. And much the way creators of literary and dramatic works are paid, to have the disparity and the equity of payment changed for the better. You know, I've had dozens of platinum and gold selling albums. It's nearly 50 years. I know I don't look it, but I took Social Security. I wanted to tell you I took Social Security this year before it runs out.
Well, that's, don't open up that one.
Well, as I said, for the most part, artists are treated equally. There's one glaring exception in today's music marketplace where musicians, artists, and sound recording copyright owners are left behind. Terrestrial radio stations do not compensate artists for our performances when they play our music over the air, which you have heard this morning. For example, you remember a little song that Stephen Sondheim wrote. I recorded Sending the Clowns in 1975, and shortly after the record's release, it became a top hit. Unfortunately, I did not earn a cent from radio when that song was played time and time again. In fact, I just came across a letter the other day when we were meeting about this conference, and I'd like to read it to you if I might. It's dated Stevens. It says Stephen Sondheim on the top. It says March 2nd, 1976. Dear Judy, and thank you for giving me my first hit song. Gratefully, Stephen Sondheim. Songwriters enjoy a performance right, and deservedly so. Stephen Sondheim deserves every penny he makes on every song. Their creativity and talent should be and is rewarded when their musical composition is played on the radio. I have recorded songs of many, many artists, Joni Mitchell, Ian and Sylvia, Stephen Sondheim, and never been paid a cent. It is a privilege to have helped them make a living. I'd like to do the same for myself with your help. It is only fair that the artists, background singers, and musicians who bring that life in the song should also be compensated. I want to tell you, just sitting here with Sam, you know, I'm thinking, God, this is a disgrace that he's not been paid for playing, for his singing on the radio. You know the other countries who do this? China, Rwanda, Sudan, Iran. Don't get me wrong, I love the radio. My father had his own radio program, as I said, and that's how I grew up listening to radio, singing on the radio. I just don't believe it's fair, nor has it ever been, that musicians and recording artists don't get paid when our music is played on the radio. Patsy Cline's heirs deserve to have that paid for play. Every other music platform, like satellite, cable, and internet radio, reward artists and musicians for our performances, and it's time radio did too. As I said at the outset, I and Sam both have been very fortunate in our careers. We work like mad, harder than ever as far as I know. There are lots of great artists and musicians who are still struggling to just earn a living doing what they do and get over that first hump of public recognition. When their music is played on the radio, they deserve to get paid. Many of my musical compatriots, like me, are on the road touring. I tour more than I ever did. I do 50 to 80 shows a year, and I've never taken a year off. I mean, as I said, I'm 68 years old, which I was not going to read into this record, but I'm very... I was advised, don't say that. I'm proud of it. I've been able to make my living in a career of my choice. I should be paid. And not being paid is like a lawyer going to a party every day and having people say, you want to practice a little law? 365 days a year. There are artists just starting out their careers. My record label, Wildflower Records, has many wonderful young artists on it. I want to see them paid for their performances on radio. Kenny White, for example, one of my artists on the label, is now on KFOG in San Francisco. He's not earning radio royalties. I was on KFOG years ago. I didn't earn radio royalties either. Yet, when his music is played on XM satellite station The Loft, he earns performance royalties. Mr. Chairman, royalties that were held by broadcasters should have been my annuity, my pension. I should have been able to retire from top hits like Amazing Grace, Both Sides Now, Someday Soon, Chelsea Morning, Who Knows Where the Time Goes, and Sending the Clowns. It's music that people love. It's not commercials. Our music sells those commercials, if you've noticed, on the radio. We simply believe that broadcasters should share the profit they earn at the expense of artists. Mr. Chairman, thank you for holding this hearing today. Songs have value, singers have value, musicians have value. We're asking for recognition of that value and urging you to change the law to right this long overdue injustice. And thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much. And now we'll turn to Charles Warfield. Is your mic on?
And members of the subcommittee, and thank you for inviting me here today to offer the broadcaster perspective on the issue of performance rights for sound recordings. My name is Charles Warfield, and I am president and COO of ICBC Broadcast Holdings, serving primarily African-American communities in New York City, San Francisco, Columbia, South Carolina, and Jackson, Mississippi. And I'm also testifying on behalf of the over 6,800 local radio members of the National Association of Broadcasters. With regard to the issue of creating a new performance royalty for sound recordings, which we do consider a performance tax on local broadcasters, NAB strongly opposes any such proposal. We oppose performance tax because compensation to the record labels and artists is provided under the current system, and the effort to upset the careful balance envisioned by Congress and beneficial to all parties for the last 80 years is misguided. The existing model works for one very significant reason: the promotional value that the record labels and artists receive from free airplay on local radio stations drives consumers to purchase music. A survey done by Critical Mass Media shows far and away FM radio is the dominant medium for listening to music. In fact, 85% of listeners identify FM radio as the place they first heard music they purchased. With an audience of 232 million listeners a week, there is no better way to expose and promote talent. Or as Tom Beery, Senior Vice President for Promotions for Warner Brothers Records, said, it is clearly the number one way that we're getting our music exposed. Nothing else affects retail sales the way terrestrial radio does. Beyond just playing music, consider the stations give away free concert tickets, conduct on-air interviews with bands releasing a new CD, or hype a newly discovered artist. Local radio is without question the engine that drives music sales. Any suggestion that radio play does not boost sales or actually diminish its sales runs counter to simple common sense. While it is true that the recording industry has seen its profits dip in this new digital world, in no way can that decline be attributed to radio. Just the opposite. Local radio is free advertising for record labels and artists and provides the best and most direct way to reach consumers. In 1995, when Congress last examined this issue, lawmakers rightly considered what new digital mediums were a threat to the sale of music. satellite and internet radio, which were covered by the 1995 law. Our service is often available by subscription, and both offer consumers true interactivity to download songs. Local radio, however, is free. There is no subscription, it is not interactive, and between disc jockey lead-ins and commercials, people are not stealing music from over-the-air radio. Congress came to the same conclusion, that local radio airplay does not threaten music sales as satellite and internet radio does, but rather directly and positively promotes the sale of music. I came to this debate from experience on both sides of this issue, from my many years in broadcasting and some years as a record label executive. What I have failed to understand after 30 years in the industry is why the recording industry is willing to essentially bite the hand that feeds it. The free airplay for free promotion concept has established a natural, symbiotic relationship between local radio and the recording industry. Both grow and flourish together. A performance tax, however, will financially hamstring broadcasters. The effect of such a dramatic increase in radio station costs will not go unnoticed. Broadcasting is an industry that is funded entirely through advertising revenue. We do not have the option of raising our subscription rates. The funding to pay for this new fee has to come from somewhere. So do we cut the $10.3 billion dollars that broadcasters donated in 2005 to public service announcements and community service for charities and other worthy causes? Do we run more advertisements, which will have the effect of playing less music, which will ultimately harm the recording industry? Or what about small urban and rural radio stations that serve niche communities, such as minority groups? There is a reason that the National Association of Black-Owned Broadcasters, or NABOB, also opposes the imposition of this tax. Finally, how will such a tax degrade the ability for stations to offer programming for the local community, such as community affairs, traffic, and essential news and weather in times of emergency? The answers are not simple, and the consequences of this debate will hit both industries in unanticipated ways. The bottom line is that there is no justification for changing the system that has worked for the music industry as a whole for so many years. The United States has the most prolific and successful music industry that is the envy of the world. Upsetting the careful balance that Congress struck by imposing a performance tax on local radio broadcasters will be a shift of seismic proportions. For over 80 years, Congress has not seen fit to alter this mutually beneficial policy, and there is no reason to do so now. And thank you for inviting me here this morning.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Warfield. And now, finally, our concluding witness, Sam Moore.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and Ranking Member Cole. My performance here this morning may be the most important gig of my career. I'm grateful to the subcommittee for holding a hearing on this vital issue that faces us American recording artists. I'm proud to be here as a founding member of the Music First Coalition, AFSTRA, RAC, the Recording Academy. Now, I'm going to okay. I'll tell you a little bit about my career, and I promise to be brief, no matter how long it takes. 40 years ago, I formed a duo that made it big in the mid-60s. Famous Sam and Dave recording became a series of top hits, as in Hold On, I'm Coming, I Thank You, and of course, a little small hit called Soul Man. You can hear those songs today on radio across the country and all over the world. That's pretty amazing. My most recent album, Overnight Sensational, was nominated for a Grammy last year, 40 years after my first nomination, but at 71, I'm still forced to go out on the road to support my family and myself. To shed light on this issue of broadcast performance royalties for artists, let me share something I hear all the time, even from some of you members of this great body just learning of this issue, who mistakenly believe I get paid when my recordings are played on the radio. You will be amazed at how shocked people are when they learn whenever I say I'm not getting nothing. No royalties whatsoever from the broadcasters for my performance. That's been overjoyed, been enjoyed by the audience, and used by them to draw that audience support and their families, to support their families. I just heard that the radio industry thinks they are going to do me some kind of favor by playing my recordings. They think that promoting me through my music so I can sell records and concert tickets may, I say, in those certain terms, radio does not, absolutely nothing to promote me or sales of my recording unless I have a current product and a huge promotional budget. People hear the bulk of my recordings so frequently on oldies stations that they don't have to buy my records at all. As for radio allowing me to tour and helping me sell tickets, well, thank you very much. But at least almost 72, I'd rather be home spending time with my grandchildren and running a golf ball thinking I'm Tiger Woods. If broadcast shared any of the money that they earn from playing my records, I would not have to continue to spend so much of my life running up and down the road. I don't have the private jets and the extravagant tour buses with staff to make my life comfortable. And my posse? My wife Joyce, the bag schlep. So while my record continues to bring joy to music lovers worldwide and continue to help the radio business become a $20 billion industry, I struggle to even make a living, even if I look successful. Broadcasters also claim they are serving the community. Well, what about the artists? Aren't we part of the community? And haven't we been struggling independently, small businessmen, before some of us got the right to vote? Those recordings are my legacy. They and I, the artists, deserve to be protected with a full performance right. In every other developed country in the world, artists have such a right. Adding an insult to injury, when my recordings are played on stations overseas, I cannot claim any of the funds paid for my songs. They're simply because the U.S. does not require payments here. I learned the other day coming here that a friend of mine, Mr. Howell Beagle, told me about little Jimmy Scott that's in the hospital that hurt his good hip. He was out working. Now he's almost going to be tossed out of the hospital because his nursing home at 85 say he can't pay. He's frail and he can't work. We're also talking about the Mary Wells, the Ruth Browns, the Junior Walkers, all worked until they died because they had to because of charity cases. Why? Mr. Chairman, this is the only thing about this whole thing is about fairness and equity. American broadcasters literally earn billions by playing our records. All we are asking is to receive what artists in every country around the world, when their recordings are broadcast, is fair compensation for the performance of our work. Our legacy is our music. Please help us fix this historic injustice. We sought the rights to help for more than 50 years. Let's just play. That's what it's all about. Personally, I pray I live to see this important legislation pass my lifetime, and I remind you, I'm looking hard at 72. I'm grateful for your invitation to share my views with you today. Thank you.
Well, thank you all very, very much, and Chair is now going to recognize the ranking member, Mr. Coble, for 5 minutes for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for this courtesy. Mr. Chairman, an outstanding panel and a superb, productive hearing, I believe. Madam Register, if the performance royalty exemption for broadcasters is eliminated, would it create a sizable impact, either negative or positive, for songwriters, performers, and the music industry as a whole?
Hopefully not. One of the things that already is in Section 114, when the very first performance, limited as it was, performance right, was created, was that was in no way to affect rights that are basically guaranteed the public performance rights for composers and for music publishers. That is also an international treaty obligation that you cannot derogate from those rights. So that has to be a commitment, both a national and international commitment. So I would say no.
I thank you for that. Mr. Whitfield, I'm going to give you a simplistic question. I think most people, strike that, maybe not most, many people respond to this issue in this way. More people are listening to music more and more each day, I'm told, because of the internet and satellite broadcasters. Why should not terrestrial broadcasters, many people ask, pay the same performance royalties that internet and satellite broadcasters pay, A? And let me put a second question to you, Mr. Warfield, if I may. Toward the conclusion of your statement, you noted that the United States commercial radio broadcasting industry was, for the most part, built by private commercial entrepreneurs. I'm in agreement with that, but who did not and do not receive 1 cent from the government or its listeners. Now, Mr. Warfield, I'm thinking now about the spectrum. What would be your estimate of cost to the industry to replace the spectrum if you were forced to pay a commercial rate for it? If you would respond to those two questions.
Well, Mr. Kogel, I can't answer the last question there in terms of what would the cost be for the spectrum. I do know, though, as a licensed broadcaster by the FCC, there are responsibilities that we all have to our communities. This public affairs program, and that we provide public interest obligations, that that we meet public service announcements that we provide to the community. There's local news and weather information that we provide, that we're obligated to provide, and we're happy to do that. We also provide essential information in the event of emergency. So there is a there's certainly obligations that we as broadcasters have with the spectrum that that we have the right to broadcast on. So, you know, I could not put a value, dollar value on that. I do know that we did provide over $10 billion worth of these types of public services in 2005, the last year that those numbers are available. So we are being responsible in that regard. In terms of the new platforms and the listening of music, I still go back to indicate that, you know, radio still reaches over 232 million listeners a week. Many of those listeners are listening to music radio, and it is still evidence that radio is still the primary means in which most of these individuals learn about new artists and new music, which they may then go to other platforms. They may decide to purchase some of that music, but there's still the awareness factor and the exposure factor that still is there as a result of the free broadcasting that we do in radio.
I thank you, sir, and I thank you all again for being with us today. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to go to the Coast Guard here, because I'm going to try to come back. But in conclusion, Mr. Chairman, I want to repeat what I said earlier. I am high on broadcasters. Do you hear me, Mr. Warfield? I'm high on broadcasters. I'm also high on performers. And I'm hoping we can strike some sort of balance, Mr. Chairman, that will result in a not-too-burdensome conclusion. And I yield back.
I think there's a song there. thank you very much, Mr. Cole.
Could I get paid for it, Mr. Chairman?
the gentleman from North Carolina, Mr. Watt.
I think if Howard's going to get paid for it, I'm not planning to sing it. Let me first thank the witnesses for being here and thank the chairman for convening the hearing. I feel kind of like the new guy on the block, as I have since I got on the subcommittee. I was reluctant to give any kind of opening statement because I'm in a learning mode and listening mode more than a talking mode. And I suspected that there had to be multiple sides to this issue, and Mr. Warfield certainly helped us paint that picture.
I feel like I'm blessed, obviously, to be in the presence of all these artists, and I'm embarrassed that I've really kind of assumed that music would be available in my life. I get mad at the radios for running commercials. I get disappointed when I can't hear exactly what I want to hear, and so and so I come to this with kind of as a blank slate, without any background in it, and I suspect the same thing will happen that has happened on the patent reform bill. That blank slate and the recognition that I am a blank slate will leave open the door for various people to come in and paint what that slate should consist of. So I suspect, Mr. Chairman, you are opening yet another one of those doors for the various interests to come and visit and try to educate me, and I look forward to that. Ms. Peters, I'm just wondering how one might approach structuring a compensation system that would both be fair to the performing artists, the writers, and not burdensome or detrimental, at least, to terrestrial radio. How would you go about, has anybody done any studies on that issue?
Remember that almost all countries in the world already have a structure in place.
And maybe I'm asking
and
the question,
Canada
how
actually
other countries
has,
doing it?
You can look at Canada. They make a difference between the size of the broadcast station, how many hours in which music is being played. We're not talking about an exclusive right where you go and negotiate with everybody. We're talking about a statutory license which guarantees equitable remuneration for the performer and the record producer. So that is what we already have in our law with regard to webcasts. The criteria could take into consideration the size of the station. There's the basic principle that you try to put in place but make it as painless as possible is what a willing buyer and a willing seller would do under the circumstances. So a small broadcaster would pay a lot less than a large broadcaster. A huge broadcaster who has music 24 hours a day, 7 days a week would pay a lot more than someone who only had music several hours a day. So I think it really isn't that difficult to achieve the correct balance.
Let me get one more question in to Mr.
Yes.
Warfield. Are you associated with radio stations in other countries? And how do you differentiate the way terrestrial radio is treated in the U.S. Vis-a-vis those other countries?
As a broadcaster, our company does not own any radio stations outside of the continental United States. But as I look at our industry here, I've not really been involved with international radio as a broadcaster in my career. However, as I look at the U.S. radio system, as I indicated in my testimony, we as broadcasters support the most lucrative and successful recording industry in the world. And under a system that we have with no performance tax, the U.S. record industry is larger than the industry for the U.K., France, Germany, Canada, Australia, Italy, Spain, Mexico combined. So I think when we talk about the relationship that has existed and the success of the recording industry, and through that success, the success of artists through this 80-year history, makes me as a broadcaster say, why would this system really need to be changed?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate you getting me in this bind again.
Well, it may be a blank slate, but it has a great deal of adhesiveness. Mr. Goodlatte.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for holding this hearing. I want to thank all the witnesses. It's been a very, very interesting hearing, and I'd be willing to hum along with Mr. Coble if he does the song that finds the cure to this. Let me start with Mr. Warfield. One of the rationales for exempting terrestrial broadcasters from the requirement to pay royalties for the public performance of sound recordings was that terrestrial radio gave performers and owners of sound recordings substantial promotional value, and that more consumers were likely to purchase these songs when they heard them on the radio. I wonder if you might comment on how the rollout of satellite radio, iPods, internet radio, and other new technologies have weakened that argument that terrestrial radio alone provides a substantial enough promotional value over these other technologies to justify keeping the exemption.
The radio industry, we are all competing against these new platforms that are emerging today. Still, terrestrial radio still reaches, as I indicated, over 230 million people per week across this country. The symbiotic partnership that still exists between radio and recorded industry has helped these companies become the envy of the world, as I had indicated. But now what we're looking at, and the challenge is that the industry, unfortunately, the record industry, has not necessarily kept up with these changing times, and then coming here as part of a coalition seeking taxes from local broadcasters to subsidize their challenged business model. It is no question that the industry is challenged today in selling music with these new alternatives that are out here, but in no way would we indicate, is there any evidence that the work that local broadcasters do and the free promotion that we provide is responsible for any of that. As I indicated, we are not...
I don't think they're suggesting they're responsible for it, but they're suggesting that if some of these other platforms are paying performance royalties, that they're also providing means by which songs are promoted, and there's a disparity there that somehow we need to find a way to bridge the gap. Ms. Peters, would you care to comment on that?
That's exactly the point, that all of these people are paying, and that the principle is that this is a copyright, and this is a right that is being exercised, and it forms the basic business model of radio stations, and that in fairness they should pay also. You can talk about under what terms and what conditions, but they should pay.
Ms. Peters, let me follow up with that. What are foreign nations doing? Are they currently withholding royalty payments to U.S. performers and sound recording owners? Their nations are not compensated when their songs are performed over U.S. terrestrial broadcasting?
It depends on the country.
I think we need a sound engineer.
Yeah, right. It depends on the country. But in many countries, they collect for all sound recordings, including U.S., and don't pay. In others, they don't collect. But under either scenario, their performers are getting paid and our performers are not, even though the performances of both are taking place in that particular country.
Thank you. Ms. Collins, would you care to comment on this relationship?
Yes, thank you. You know, it's interesting. I'm sitting here wondering about class action suits. You know, all of the artists, excluding the issue of whether or not we should be paid as artists in this country, and I think I have settled that in my own mind, we certainly should, and it should be a sliding scale for those who can afford more, for those who can afford less. But the fact that my records across the world...
They'll stop in a minute.
...have not been paid for means that many, many thousands, millions perhaps, of artists over a period of, what is it, 80 years? Is that the... It's 80 years. 80 years, and all of these musicians who are not being paid in countries which have laws which protect the artist, where is that money? It's not in my pocket. And in the case of Amazing Grace, which played in around the world and which most of you know, Amazing Grace, you know, how sweet the sound. How sweet the free sound, it turns out. I'm curious about that idea, because with this coalition of artists, that might be a subject that we might want to bring up. We're certainly not talking about a retroactive situation, although legally we might. But the idea of the money that's sitting internationally and why we don't respect other artists in this country who are not receiving payments for their performances either. It's a complicated question, but once we solve this one, then we'll look at that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. The bells are gone off. The situation is we have about 15 more minutes and then three votes, and then we'll come back. But I do believe we have time for one more witness before we recess. So, generally from Texas, Sheila Jackson.
Chairman, thank you. Let me add my affirmation that you managed to find the armadillo in the middle of the road when it comes to questions that I think are enormously important. Let me quickly go to the esteemed Sam and Dave, but Mr. Moore, thank you, all of you, for your testimony. Would you just give me the list of names? I happen to represent, I believe, the last remaining member of the Ink Spots. He is close to 100-plus years old. He's living in a nursing home. I would imagine what he would be able to find a way to live if we had some altering of this process. Would you just give me the names of those who have suffered? Jackie Wilson, I know, had a terrible time, but you mentioned Billy Preston. Are there any others? Would you just mention some of those names for us that really have suffered in the later years of their life?
Well, let's see. You said Jackie Wilson, yes. How about Bo Diddley? That was in Iowa not long ago, about two or three weeks ago, working on stage and had a stroke. Now, you must understand that before the stroke, he was an amputee on his left foot. Now, you know, if he was getting performance pay, he could have that $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 a month to pay and not worry about taking care of his bills or his family or anything else. He could not worry about anything other than taking care of his health. So that's
those are glaring examples. Thank you very much. And Ms. Peters, can you give me any legally speaking, is there any way to justify the sole exemption of sound recordings from a performance right? And do you know how such exemption came about? And because bells are ringing, I'm asking for quick songs at this point.
The answer is no, I don't know of a justification. I have been advocating this for almost 25-plus years, and before that my predecessors have. I will argue, and I think I sort of suggested it, that it's the effectiveness of the broadcast lobby.
And the 1998, the Register, which was that you in 1998?
No, it was Barbara Ringer.
Went on record affirmatively for that.
And I have gone on
for that position of those payments.
Yes.
Would you understand the value of, as we try to forge, which I think my good friend Howard Cobble suggested, a reason place in the middle, the exemption of certain small radio stations, which would probably suffer greatly and close if they were to come under such a requirement?
I believe that when you craft the solution, you craft it so that it's equitable. The yes, the basic principle is paying, but yes, you can have special provisions and even exemptions for small broadcasters.
Thank you. Mr. Warfield, broadcasters have labeled the payment to artists a performance tax. Is that how you're viewing payments to songwriters for radio play, or do you view them as royalty payments? Why wouldn't payments to performers be royalty payments?
The performance tax that we're discussing today would go to what is referred to as artists and record companies who, in the existing system, benefit greatly from the free on-air airplay of their product. Record sales result from that, which benefits the artist as well as the record label at this point, whereas the composers of the music, the writers of the music, do not receive that type of a benefit, which is why there are payments being made to them and have been statutorily required throughout the our broadcast industry.
I think the industry has changed so much, Mr. Warfield, and I want to thank you for your leadership, that probably is not accurate. I can't really agree that there is such an enormous benefit to performers that we would classify one as a tax and one as a royalty. But I hope we can find common ground. I don't want to leave my good friend, Congressman Holtz, out of for the fact that people should know that he sings very well, even as a congressperson, and we have enjoyed very much his singing. But, Congressman, just is there a way to balance this? And I might conclude quickly by asking Ms. Collins, should we not have a balance on the royalty payments on these Internet radio royalties where Clear Channel, Yahoo, and Microsoft pay so much? Should we not have royalty rates for that lower level that will create music diversity? So I'm going to go to Congressman, and then since I got in before the light, if you'd be able to answer that. Congressman?
Thank you for the question. Very quickly, there are models that are already in place that point the way to the kind of balanced and fair system that this committee, with its expertise, is well capable of crafting. Ms. Peters has talked about sliding scales. There are potential exemptions. There are lots of ways to make this work, and we already have some models in what has happened in the digital realm.
Ms. Collins, I would hear Amazing Grace forever, but the chairman is going to gavel me down just to balance out the Internet rates, should they be?
I believe that the equitable distribution of royalties, not taxes, should be worked on, and a fair and equitable decision made about this. But I want to just remind us of why we're really here. We in this country do not recognize the value of our artists as we do in other countries. That's really what this is about. We have devalued the contribution of great, great, great artists, and that needs to be remedied.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We will now recess. We hope very much that all of you can stay, because if you do, we'll come back.
Good.
Okay.
Thank you. I hope I can help you. Sir, let's come to a good agreement.